Some switch causes the patient's immune system to eradicate all cancer cells from the body. These people would have been equally cured by drinking a glass of Vermont spring water or chewing on dried beef as they were by taking these beautifully wrapped pills. Finally, these spontaneous remissions might not be so spontaneous. They might, at the bottom, have a cause that we are not yet sophisticated enough to detect. The late astronomer Carl Sagan, a devoted promoter of scientific thinking and an obsessive enemy of non-science, examined the cures from cancer that resulted from a visit to Lourdes in France, where people were healed by simple contact with the holy waters, and found out the interesting fact that of the total cancer patients who visited the place, the cure rate was, if anything, lower than the statistical one for spontaneous remissions. It was lower than the average for those who did not go to Lourdes. Should a statistician infer here that cancer patients' odds of surviving deteriorates after a visit to Lourdes? Professor Pearson goes to Monte Carlo, literally. Randomness does not look random. At the beginning of the 20th century, as we were starting to develop techniques to deal with the notion of random outcomes, several methods were designed to detect anomalies. Father of Egon Pearson, of Nyman Pearson fame, familiar to every person who sat in a Statistics 101 class, devised the first test of non-randomness. It was in reality a test of deviation from normality, which for all intents and purposes was the same thing. He examined millions of runs of what was called a Monte Carlo, the old name for a roulette wheel, during the month of July 1902. He discovered that with a high degree of statistical significance, with an error of less than 1 to a billion, the runs were not purely random. What? The roulette wheel was not random? Professor Pearson was greatly surprised at the discovery. But this result in itself tells us nothing. We know that there is no such thing as a pure random draw, for the outcome of the draw depends on the quality of the equipment. With enough minutia, one would be able to uncover the non-randomness somewhere. For instance, the wheel itself may not have been perfectly balanced, or perhaps the spinning ball was not completely spherical. Philosophers of statistics call this the reference case problem, to explain that there is no true attainable randomness in practice, only in theory. Besides, a manager would question whether such non-randomness can lead to any meaningful, profitable rules. If I need to gamble $1 on 10,000 runs and expect to make $1 for my efforts, then I would do much better in the part-time employment of a janitorial agency. But the result bears another suspicious element. Of more practical relevance here is the following severe problem about non-randomness. Even the fathers of statistical science forgot that a random series of runs need not exhibit a pattern to look random. As a matter of fact, data that is perfectly patternless would be extremely suspicious and appear to be man-made. A single random run is bound to exhibit some pattern if one looks hard enough. Note that Professor Pearson was among the first scholars who were interested in creating artificial random data generators, tables one could use as inputs for various scientific and engineering simulations, the precursors of our Monte Carlo simulator. The problem is that they did not want these tables to exhibit any form of regularity. Yet real randomness does not look random. I would further illustrate the point with the study of a phenomenon well known as cancer clusters. Consider a square with 16 random darts hitting it with equal probability of being at any place in the square. If we divide the square into 16 smaller squares, it is expected that each smaller square will contain one dart on average, but only on average. There is a very small probability of having exactly 16 darts in 16 different squares. The average grid will have more than one dart in a few squares, and no dart at all in many squares. It will be an exceptionally rare incident that no cancer cluster would show on the grid. Now transpose our grid with the darts in it to overlay a map of any region. Some newspaper will declare that one of the areas, the one with more than the average of darts, harbors radiation that causes cancer, prompting lawyers to start soliciting the patients. The Dog That Did Not Bark, on Biases in Scientific Knowledge. By the same argument, science is marred by a pernicious survivorship bias, affecting the way research gets published. In a way that is similar to journalism, research that yields no result does not make it to print. That may seem sensible, as newspapers do not have to have a screaming headline saying that nothing new is taking place, though the Bible was smart enough to declare nothing new under the sun, providing the information that things just do recur. The problem is that a finding of absence and an absence of findings get mixed together. There may be great information in the fact that nothing took place. As Sherlock Holmes noted in the Silver Blaze case, the curious thing was that the dog did not bark. More problematic, there are plenty of scientific results that are left out of publications because they are not statistically significant, but nevertheless provide information. I have no conclusion. I am frequently asked the question, when is it truly not luck? There are professions in randomness for which performance is low in luck, like casinos, which manage to tame randomness. In finance? Perhaps. All traders are not speculative traders. There exists a segment called market makers, whose job is to derive, like bookmakers, or even like store owners, an income against a transaction. If they speculate, their dependence on the risks of such speculation remains too small compared to their overall volume. They buy at a price and sell to the public at a more favorable one, performing large numbers of transactions. Such income provides them some insulation from randomness. Such category includes floor traders on the exchanges, bank traders who trade against order flow, money changers in the souks of the Levant. The skills involved are sometimes rare to find. Fast thinking, alertness, a high level of energy, an ability to guess from the voice of the seller her level of nervousness. Those who have them make a long career, that is, perhaps a decade. They never make it big, as their income is constrained by the number of customers, but they do well probabilistically. They are, in a way, the dentists of the profession. Outside of this very specialized bookmaker-style profession, to be honest, I am unable to answer the question of who's lucky or unlucky. I can tell that person A seems less lucky than person B, but the confidence in such knowledge can be so weak as to be meaningless. I prefer to remain a skeptic. People frequently misinterpret my opinion. I never say that every rich man is an idiot and every unsuccessful person unlucky, only that in absence of much additional information, it is preferable to reserve one's judgment. It is safer. Chapter 10, Loser Takes All, on the Non-Linearities of Life. The Non-Linear Viciousness of Life, Moving to Bel Air and Acquiring the Vices of the Rich and Famous, Why Microsoft's Bill Gates May Not Be the Best in His Business, But Please Do Not Inform Him of Such a Fact. Depriving Donkeys of Food. Next, I put the platitude, life is unfair, under some examination, but from a new angle. The twist? Life is unfair in a non-linear way. This chapter is about how a small advantage in life can translate into a highly disproportionate payoff, or more viciously, how no advantage at all, but a very, very small help from randomness, can lead to a bonanza. The Sandpile Effect. First, we define non-linearity. There are many ways to present it, but one of the most popular ones in science is what is called the sandpile effect, which I can illustrate as follows. I am currently sitting on a beach in Copacabana in Rio de Janeiro, attempting to do nothing strenuous, away from anything to read and write. Unsuccessfully, of course, as I am mentally writing these lines. I am playing with plastic beach toys borrowed from a child, trying to build an edifice, modestly but doggedly attempting to emulate the Tower of Babel. I continuously add sand to the top, slowly raising the entire structure. My Babylonian relatives thought they could thus reach the heavens. I have more humble designs, to test how high I can go before it topples. I keep adding sand, testing to see how the structure will ultimately collapse. Unused to seeing adults build sandcastles, a child looks at me with amazement. In time, and much to the onlooking child's delight, my castle inevitably topples to rejoin the rest of the sand on the beach. It could be said that the last grain of sand is responsible for the destruction of the entire structure. What we are witnessing here is a non-linear effect, resulting from a linear force exerted on an object. A very small additional input, here the grain of sand, caused a disproportionate result, namely, the destruction of my starter tower of Babel. Popular wisdom has integrated many such phenomena, as witnessed by such expressions as the straw that broke the camel's back, or the drop that caused the water to spill. These nonlinear dynamics have a bookstore name, chaos theory, which is a misnomer because it has nothing to do with chaos. Chaos theory concerns itself primarily with functions in which a small input can lead to a disproportionate response. Population models, for instance, can lead to a path of explosive growth or extinction of a species, depending on a very small difference in the population at a starting point in time. Another popular scientific analogy is the weather, where it has been shown that a simple butterfly fluttering its wings in India can cause a hurricane in New York. But the classics have their share to offer as well. Pascal, he of the wager in Chapter 7, said that if Cleopatra's nose had been slightly shorter, the world's fate would have changed. Cleopatra had comely features dominated by a thin, an elongated nose that made Julius Caesar and his successor, Mark Antony, fall for her. Here the intellectual snob in me cannot resist dissenting against conventional wisdom. Plutarch claimed that it was Cleopatra's skills in conversation, rather than her good looks, that caused the maddening infatuation of the shakers and movers of her day. I truly believe it. Enter randomness. Things can become more interesting when randomness enters the game. Imagine a waiting room full of actors queuing for an audition. The number of actors who will win is clearly small, and they are the ones generally observed by the public as representative of the profession, as we saw in our discussion on survivorship bias. The winners would move into Bel Air, feel pressure to acquire some basic training in the consumption of luxury goods, and perhaps, owing to the dissolute and unrhythmic lifestyle, flirt with substance abuse. As to the others, the great majority, we can imagine their fate, a lifetime of serving foamed cafe latte at the neighboring Starbucks, fighting the biological clock between auditions. One may argue that the actor who lands the lead role that catapults him into fame and expensive swimming pools has some skills the others lack, some charm, or a specific physical trait that is a perfect match for such a career path. I beg to differ. The winner may have some acting skills, but so do all of the others. Otherwise, they would not be in the waiting room. It is an interesting attribute of fame that it has its own dynamics. An actor becomes known by some parts of the public because he is known by other parts of the public. The dynamics of such fame follow a rotating helix, which may have started at the audition, as the selection could have been caused by some silly detail that fitted the mood of the examiner on that day. Had the examiner not fallen in love the previous day with a person with a similar-sounding last name, then our selected actor from that particular sample history would be serving cafe latte in the intervening sample history. Learning to type. Researchers frequently use the example of QWERTY, Q-W-E-R-T-Y, to describe the vicious dynamics of winning and losing in an economy, and to illustrate how the final outcome is more than frequently the undeserved one. The arrangement of the letters on a typewriter is an example of the success of the least deserving method. For our typewriters have the order of the letters on their keyboard arranged in a non-optimal manner. As a matter of fact, in such a non-optimal manner as to slow down the typing rather than make the job easy, in order to avoid jamming the ribbons as they were designed for less electronic days. Therefore, as we started building better typewriters and computerized word processors, several attempts were made to rationalize the computer keyboard. To no avail. People were trained on a QWERTY keyboard, and their habits were too sticky for change. Just like the helical propulsion of an actor into stardom, people patronize what other people like to do. Forcing rational dynamics on the process would be superfluous, nay, impossible. This is called a path-dependent outcome, and has thwarted many mathematical attempts at modeling behavior. It is obvious that the information age, by homogenizing our tastes, is causing the unfairness to be even more acute. Those who win capture almost all the customers. The example that strikes many as the most spectacular lucky success is that of the software maker Microsoft and its moody founder Bill Gates. While it is hard to deny that Gates is a man of high personal standards, work ethics, and above-average intelligence, is he the best? Does he deserve it? Clearly not. Most people are equipped with his software, like myself, because other people are equipped with his software. A purely circular effect. Economists call that network externalities. Nobody ever claimed that it was the best software product. Most of Gates' rivals have an obsessive jealousy of his success. They are maddened by the fact that he managed to win so big, while many of them are struggling to make their company survive. Such ideas go against classical economic models, in which results either come from a precise reason, there is no account for uncertainty, or the good guy wins. The good guy is the one who is more skilled and has more technical superiority. Economists discovered path-dependent effects late in their game, then tried to publish wholesale on the topic that otherwise would be bland and obvious. For instance, Brian Arthur, an economist concerned with nonlinearities at the Santa Fe Institute, wrote that chance events coupled with positive feedback, rather than technological superiority, will determine economic superiority, not some abstrusely defined edge in a given area of expertise. While early economic models excluded randomness, Arthur explained how unexpected orders, chance meetings with lawyers, managerial whims, would help determine which ones achieved early sales, and over time, which firms dominated. Mathematics inside and outside the real world. A mathematical approach to the problem is in order. While in conventional models, such as the well-known Brownian random walk used in finance, the probability of success does not change with every incremental step, only the accumulated wealth. Arthur suggests models such as the Puglia process, which is mathematically very difficult to work with, but can be easily understood with the aid of a Monte Carlo simulator. The Puglia process can be presented as follows. Assume an urn initially containing equal quantities of black and red balls. You are to guess, each time, which color you will pull out before you make the draw. Here, the game is rigged. Unlike a conventional urn, the probability of guessing correctly depends on past success, as you get better or worse at guessing, depending on past performance. Thus, the probability of winning increases after past wins. That of losing increases after past losses. Simulating such a process, one can see a huge variance of outcomes, with astonishing successes and a large number of failures, what we called skewness. Compare such a process with those that are more commonly modeled, that is, an urn from which the player makes guesses with replacement. Say you played roulette and won.